This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Cindy reading for the New York Times NewsHour. Today is Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. The first article of the day, hope rises for new talks on Gaza ceasefire as Israel scales back demands. Israel reduced the initial number of hostages it wants released to 33 if Hamas agrees to attend negotiations on a ceasefire could resume in Cairo this week. This article is written by Patrick Kingsley, Edward Wong, Adam Razgon, and Eric Nagurny. Patrick Kingsley reported from Jerusalem, and Edward Wong was traveling with the U.S. Secretary of State. Israeli negotiators offering a hint of hope for negotiations over a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip have reduced the number of hostages they want Hamas to release during the first phase of a truce, three Israeli officials said on Monday. For weeks, ceasefire talks have been at a standstill. Now, with the new proposal in hand, a mid-ranking delegation from Israel was planning to fly to Cairo on Tuesday to resume them, but only if Hamas agrees to attend, according to two of the officials. They spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive issue. Hamas did not respond to a request for comment about whether it would send representatives to Cairo. A senior Hamas official said on social media on Monday that the group was studying a new Israeli proposal. The American Secretary of State, Antony J. Blinken, who was meeting in Saudi Arabia on Monday with Arab diplomats, said the onus was now on Hamas. Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel, Mr. Blinken said at an economic forum in Riyadh. And at the moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. Speaking at the same forum, the British Foreign Minister David Cameron said the offer included a sustained 40-day ceasefire and the release of potentially thousands of Palestinians imprisoned in Israel in exchange for the hostages being held by Hamas. The Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry said he was hopeful about the latest ceasefire offer, though he did not say what it involved or who had made it. Seeking to increase the pressure on Hamas leaders to accept the ceasefire deal, President Biden planned to speak on Monday with the leaders of Egypt and Qatar. But other serious obstacles may remain, among them Hamas demand for a permanent ceasefire and Israel's insistence on pursuing its goal of rooting out the militants, including in their last bastion in the southern city of Rafah. And there was also concern that ceasefire talks might be disrupted if the International Criminal Court issues arrest warrants for senior Israeli government officials on charges related to the conflict in Hamas, as Israeli and foreign officials believe is in the works. The warrants may also name Hamas officials. Hamas and its allies captured roughly 240 Israelis and foreigners in the deadly October 7th attack that set off the war. During a week-long ceasefire in November, Hamas released 105 captives in exchange for 240 Palestinians being held in Israeli prisons. In recent months, Israel has been demanding that Hamas release at least 40 more hostages, women, older people, and those who are seriously ill, to secure a new truce. Now it is prepared to settle for only 33, the Israeli officials said. The shift was prompted partly by the fact that Israel now believes that some of the 40 have died in captivity, according to one of the officials. Even as expectations rose that Hamas and Israeli negotiators might be edging closer to their first truce since the November ceasefire, their fighters were pressing on. In Gaza, Israeli airstrikes flattened concrete buildings overnight, according to news agencies, which published video on Monday of rows of body bags. The Reuters news agency said the strikes had killed 20 people. The Israeli military issued a statement on Monday saying that its fighter jets struck terror targets where terrorists were operating within a civilian area in southern Gaza. More than 1 million Gazans have crowded into shelters and tents in Rafah seek safety from Israel's military offensive. One survivor, carrying a baby she said had been pulled from the rubble, told a Reuters video journalist that the child appeared to be uninjured, but that her parents had been killed. "Look at us with some compassion, with some humanity," said the woman, Fayez Abu Daha. "This is all we ask for. We're not asking for much. Just end the war, nothing more." In northern Israel, a salvo of Hamas rockets came over the border from Lebanon. The Qassam Brigades, Hamas's military wing, said in a statement that it had targeted an Israeli military position in Kiryat Shmona, the largest city in Israel's far north, with a concentrated rocket barrage. Though Hamas is based in Gaza, many of its leaders are living in exile in Lebanon, where the group has a sizable presence. Since the war began, Hamas has occasionally launched rocket attacks into northern Israel from there, though its ally, Hezbollah, the Lebanese militant group, has launched far more. Both groups are backed by Iran. The rocket barrage on Monday, which was reported to have done little damage, was likely an attempt by Hamas to signal it was still part of the fight, said Mohanad Haga Ali, a Beirut-based fellow with the Carnegie Middle East Center. After arriving in Riyadh shortly after dawn, Secretary of State Blinken met with the Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan and then with foreign ministers and top foreign policy advisors from five other Arab nations. Mr. Blinken spoke with them about the war and the challenges it has created, from getting humanitarian aid into Gaza to freeing the hostages. The American Secretary of State and the Saudi Foreign Minister also talked about greater regional integration and a pathway to a Palestinian state with security guarantees for Israel. The State Department summary said, later in the day, Mr. Blinken met with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, and then attended a working dinner with officials from five Arab and five European nations to discuss the war. He planned to travel to Jordan and Israel on Tuesday. In its best-case scenario, the Biden administration envisions Saudi Arabia and perhaps a few other Arab nations agreeing to normalize diplomatic relations with Israel. In exchange, Saudi Arabia would receive advanced weapons and security guarantees, including a mutual defense treaty from the United States and commitment for U.S. cooperation on a civilian nuclear program in the kingdom. For its part, Israel would have to commit to a concrete pathway to the founding of a Palestinian nation with specific deadlines, American and Saudi officials say. At the Economic Forum in Saudi Arabia, Mr. Cameron, the British foreign minister, said that something else must happen for the conflict to end. The people responsible for October 7th, the Hamas leadership, would have to leave Gaza. Okay, so we're moving on to the next article. Even with Gaza under siege, some are imagining its reconstruction. International development agencies have been meeting with Middle East business interests and urban planners to map out an economic future for the territory. This piece is by Peter S. Goodman. On a December morning in central London, more than two dozen people drawn from influential institutions across the Middle East, Europe, and the United States gathered in a conference room to pursue an aspiration that, at the moment, verged on preposterous. They were there to plan for the reconstruction and long-term economic development of Gaza. Gaza was under relentless bombardment by Israeli military forces in response to terrorist attacks launched by Hamas in October. Communities throughout the territory were being reduced to rubble, and tens of thousands of people had been killed. Families confronted the immediacy of hunger, fear, and grief. Yet at the meeting in London, members of the international establishment discussed how to eventually transform Gaza from a place defined by isolation and poverty into a Mediterranean commercial hub centered on trade, tourism, and innovation, yielding a middle class. The group included senior officials from American and European economic development agencies, executives from Middle Eastern finance and construction companies, and two partners from the international consulting firm McKinsey & Company. Officially, they were attending only as individuals, not as representatives of their institutions. The plan they produced is far removed from the dire reality confronting Gaza today. Turning it into reality would require the end of a war that has left the territory devastated, to say nothing of tens of billions of dollars in investment. It would also demand resolution to the monumental and entirely uncertain political question of who eventually controls Gaza, and then the cooperation of that authority. All of that makes the plan well short of a blueprint for action. Yet participants maintain that the mere exercise of mapping out a more prosperous future holds value because it can prepare the way for projects once conditions are suitable, a notion that has propelled such planning in conflict zones like Kuwait after it was invaded by Iraq and Ukraine. "We are proposing to connect Gaza to the world over the long term," said Chris Choa, founder and director of Outcomist, a London firm that designs large-scale urban development projects and one of the initial conveners of the group known as A Palestine Emerging. Among those involved are Hashim Shawa, chairman of the Bank of Palestine, a commercial bank, Samar Khoury, chief executive of Consolidated Contractors International, a construction company engaged in major projects across the Middle East, and Mohammed Abouka Hazarin, a board member of the Arab Hospitals Group, a medical provider in the Western Bank. All would potentially have a stake in the eventual work of rebuilding. "As soon as the war started, my team and I started developing a plan to build a facility in Gaza as soon as the war ends," Mr. Abzouk Zarin said in an interview. "The group is clear that the most pressing work is the delivery of food, water, healthcare, and emergency shelter to the residents of Gaza, who are now contending with catastrophe. But the primary focus of its plan is on the rebuilding that would unfold over the next decades. The Gaza war needs to end immediately, and there will be an incredible and immediate humanitarian effort," Mr. Abouka Zarin said. "But we also need to think long-term about building a better future for Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank." The initiative, one of several under discussion, has gained the interest and advice of major international funding organizations, including the World Bank, said a senior agency official who spoke on the condition of anonymity because the person was not authorized to talk publicly. The bank views the plan as a useful contribution toward a strategy that could generate jobs in Gaza by integrating the territory into the global economy. Representatives for U.S. government agencies have attended Palestine Emerging workshops and offered counsel on the details of the plan, a senior American official said, also speaking on the condition of not being named. American engagement with the initiative has been driven by the assumption that greater economic opportunity in Gaza is necessary to undercut popular support for Hamas, the official added. The plan centers on a series of major projects, including a deep water port, a desalination plant to provide drinking water, and online healthcare service, and a transportation corridor connecting Gaza with the West Bank. A fund for reconstruction and development would oversee future undertakings. The most forward-looking components, such as reducing customs barriers to trade and introducing a new currency in place of the Israeli shekel, assume the eventual establishment of Palestinian autonomy, a step that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to resist. He has also brushed aside the prospect that the future governance of Gaza could include a role for the Palestinian Authority, the most obvious potential partner for the reconstruction initiative. The enormous price tag of any rebuilding is another impediment. The toll of the damage to Gaza's crucial infrastructure has reached $18.5 billion, according to a recent estimate by the World Bank and the United Nations. Half the population is on the verge of famine, and more than a million people lack homes. Who might deliver such funding is among the largest variables. A previous development plan for the Palestinian territories, advanced by the Trump administration in 2019, envisioned substantial investment from Persian Gulf countries like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. The new initiative has yet to engage with Gulf countries, Mr. Choa said. The imperative for development in Gaza predates the current war. The unemployment rate in the territory was more than 45% in 2022, according to the World Bank. More than half the population was living in poverty, according to the International Monetary Fund. While visions of modern transportation systems may now seem tangential to Gaza's essential needs, the plan is governed by the assumption that even temporary structures like emergency housing and healthcare facilities must be thoughtfully placed to avoid squandering future possibilities. Temporary tends to become permanent very quickly, Mr. Choa said. Someone says, we're going to put this big refugee camp right here, but that could be exactly where you want to put a wastewater treatment plant or a transit line in the future. You then create an obstacle. Mr. Choa, 64, has spent much of his international architectural career wrestling with such details. After the attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, he took part in a commission assigned the task of sketching out the future of Lower Manhattan. He later lived and worked in China, where he oversaw master plans in major urban areas. After moving to London in 2006, he continued such work in Europe, Central Asia, and the Middle East. He first grappled with a detailed plan for Gaza in 2015 through work commissioned by Palestinian business interests. He led several missions to Gaza, meeting with the Palestinian Authority and the arm of the Israeli Defense Forces that administered the territory. But the pandemic and Israeli concerns about security halted the effort. In the wake of Hamas attacks on Israel in October, he sought to revive the project, joining forces with Baron Frankel, chief executive of the Portland Trust, a London-based organization that pursues economic opportunities for Palestinians. After the December meeting in London, an expanded group of 58 gathered in Washington in early March. A meeting was held recently in Ramallah, a city in the West Bank. Another meeting is planned for Tel Aviv in early June. The group has briefed the Palestinian Authority, which administers parts of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, Mr. Frankel said. One member of the initiative, Wael Zakout, a former World Bank official, recently joined the cabinet of the incoming Palestinian government. The group has not engaged Hamas, which had overseen Gaza since 2007 and is widely condemned as a terrorist organization. If Hamas are still players, people are not going to invest tens of billions of dollars, said Stephen Byers, a former British cabinet secretary in the Tony Blair government, who attended the London meeting. The ideas that have emerged from the workshops extend into the next quarter century. These include the erection of a cutting-edge soccer stadium and the elevation of the existing soccer team to a more internationally competitive level, and the creation of a strategy to encourage a Palestinian film industry. The deep water port would be established on an artificial island built from the nearly 30 million tons of debris and rubble that are expected to cover the territory whenever the conflict is over, with removal anticipated to take as long as a decade. The plan proposes the establishment of a degree-granting technical university of reconstruction in northern Gaza that would draw students from around the world. They would study strategies to dig out from disaster and spur development, using post-war Gaza as a living laboratory. The destruction is so extensive that the usual means of administering aid and overseeing rebuilding will be inadequate, the World Bank officials said. American government agencies face legal restrictions on working directly with a Palestinian authority. Other institutions are reluctant to transact with the Palestinian authority given its reputation for corruption. All of this makes private companies critical elements of the plan, even as they too will grapple with the risks of investing in a highly uncertain climate. While the largest projects require clarity over the future political administration of Gaza, other initiatives, such as those aimed at encouraging small businesses, could begin as soon as military activities cease. I want to focus on how we open the bread store, how we get factories up and running, said Jim Pickup, chief executive of the Middle East Investment Initiative, a nonprofit that finances development projects. Every truck that is going to remove rubble is a small business itself, supporting a family. Okay, moving on. We have 8 officers are shot, 4 fatally, while serving warrant in Charlotte. 3 of the 4 were part of a U.S. Marshals task force. The felon whom they sought was also killed. This article is by Sopan Deb, Livia Albeck Ripka, Eduardo Medina, and Remy Tumin. Eduardo Medina reported from Charlotte. 8 law officers were shot on Monday, 4 fatally, as the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force tried to serve a warrant in Charlotte, North Carolina, the police said, in one of the deadliest days for law enforcement in recent years. Around 1:30 p.m., members of the task force went to serve a warrant on a person for being a felon in possession of a firearm, Johnny Jennings, the chief of police of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, said at a news conference Monday evening. When they approached the residence, the suspect, later identified as Terry Clark Hughes Jr., fired at them, the police said. The officers returned fire and struck Mr. Hughes, 39. He was later pronounced dead in the front yard of the residence. As the police approached the shooter, Chief Jennings told reporters, the officers were met with more gunfire from inside the home. After a long standoff, 2 women in the home were taken to a police station to be interviewed, the police later said in a statement. Today is an absolute tragic day for the city of Charlotte and for the profession of law enforcement, Chief Jennings said. Today, we lost some heroes that are simply trying to keep our community safe. In all, 4 members of the task force were shot, 3 of whom died. The North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections said in a statement that 2 of its veteran officers, Sam Palocci and Alden Elliott, were killed. The U.S. Marshals Service confirmed that one of its deputy marshals was among those killed. The task force is made up of officers from multiple agencies. 4 members of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department were also shot. One of them died from his injuries on Monday night, the police said on social media. The officer, Joshua Iyer, who had been with the department for 6 years, was helping other officers arrest the suspect when he was shot, the police said. He fought for several hours and passed away from his injuries with his wife and family by his side tonight, Chief Jennings said in a statement posted to social media on Monday evening. I am truly grateful for his bravery, service, and ultimate sacrifice, he said. The authorities shut down the city's Shannon Park neighborhood east of downtown on Monday afternoon after gunfire erupted in order to more easily move victims to the hospitals, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department wrote on social media. By evening, shelter-in-place orders had been lifted. A yellow crime scene tape sectioned off part of the street where the shooting had occurred. 2 black SWAT vehicles drove away from the site. Janice Williams, a neighbor, said she believed three or four people lived inside the home where the shooting took place and that nothing had stuck out to her about them. They were pretty much quiet to themselves, she said. I'm sorry that this ever happened. Charlene Middleton, a 36-year-old school counselor, has lived in the area for her whole life and since 2015 in a home across the street from the incident where the incident occurred. When she returned home from work in the evening, she said, she saw casing scattered all over the street as well as a large police presence. Although, she said, there had been occasional shootings in the area, she could not recall any of this magnitude. Another resident, Mary Sutter, said she had trouble returning home from her job at a nearby high school because the neighborhood was so packed with police cars. We're all just shocked that this happened here, she said. In a statement on Monday night, President Biden shared his condolences with the families of the officers who had been killed and injured in the shootout. They are heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice, rushing into harm's way to protect us, he said. We mourn for them and their loved ones, and we pray for the recoveries of the courageous officers who were wounded. The president urged leaders in Congress to take action to combat the scourge of gun violence by banning assault weapons in high-capacity magazines and by passing universal background checks, among other measures. Enough is enough, he said. Vi Lyles, the mayor of Charlotte, said at the news conference, "These are people that care deeply about what they've done for a profession, and now today we have to say to them how much we are grateful for what they have done." Governor Cooper expressed his condolences on social media to the families and co-workers of officers in today's brutal attack. And in a statement, Attorney General Merrick B. Garland said, "Every single day, Deputy U.S. Marshals and Task Force officers put their lives on the line to apprehend some of our country's most dangerous criminals. The Justice Department is heartbroken by the deaths," he said. The violent episode on Monday was one of the deadliest attacks on law enforcement in recent years. In July 2016, five officers were killed in Texas after an armed sniper opened fire in downtown Dallas during a demonstration against fatal police shootings. Four Dallas police officers and one transit officer were killed. The police killed the gunman, Micah Johnson, 25, with an explosive sent by a remote-controlled robot. That same month, three officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, were killed, and three others were wounded in what the authorities described as an ambush. The gunman was killed during a shootout. In February, two police officers and a paramedic were killed near Minneapolis after a man who was barricaded in his home opened fire on the police. Officers returned fire, and the gunman was later reported dead. This month, two police officers were killed outside a home near Syracuse, New York, during a shootout after they were following up on a traffic violation. The suspect also died in the shootout. Chief Jennings said that in his more than three decades with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, he couldn't imagine that there's one that's any worse than what we're seeing today in the Charlotte area. The next article is College Protests Over Gaza Deepen Democratic Rifts. Scenes of chaos unfolding on campuses across the country are stoking internal divisions and carry political risk as a major election year unfolds. This article is written by Katie Gluick. Nearly 7 months after the Israel-Hamas war began, the demonstrations convulsing college campuses nationwide are exposing fresh tensions within the Democratic Party over how to balance free speech protections and support for Gazans with concerns that some Jewish Americans are raising about anti-Semitism. From New York and Los Angeles to Atlanta and Austin, a surge in student activism has manifested in protest encampments and other demonstrations, drawing significant police crackdowns and sometimes appearing to attract outside agitators. The protests also have emerged as the latest flashpoint in the internal Democratic debate over the war. As scenes of campus turmoil play out across the country in the final days of the school year, the moment also carries political risk for a party that has harnessed promises of stability and normalcy to win critical recent elections and faces a challenging battle for control of the government in the fall. The real question is, can the Democrats again portray themselves as the steady hand at the helm? Said Dan Cena, a veteran Democratic strategist. Things that create national chaos like this make that harder to do. Mr. Cena and the Democrats have argued that Americans have good reason to associate their opponents with chaos. Former President Donald J. Trump faces multiple criminal cases. The narrow, fractious House Republican majority has its own divisions concerning Israel and free speech. Some Republicans have urged National Guard deployments to college campuses, and for years Republicans have faced criticism over anti-Semitism in their own ranks. But since the Hamas-led attack on Israel on October 7th, the Israeli military response that has killed more than 30,000 people, according to local authorities, the fight over American policy toward Israel has been especially pronounced on the left. Most Democrats say they both support free speech and condemn anti-Semitism and consider criticism of the Israeli government to be fair game. But in seeking to address an intractable conflict marked by competing historical narratives, debates over how to distinguish between legitimate criticism of Israel and anti-Semitic speech are fraught and reaching a fever pitch on campus. To some lawmakers who have visited encampments and attended demonstrations, the students are part of a long tradition of campus activism, and their free speech rights are at risk. Incidents of anti-Semitism, they say, do not reflect a broader movement that includes many young progressive Jews. Representative Greg Kassar of Texas went to the University of Texas to show solidarity with demonstrators, linking their activism to that of students who opposed the Vietnam and Iraq wars. So often, history ends up vindicating those who call for peace early, he said. I do think that more and more members of Congress will start to show up at these events and start to hear out more and more of where students are coming from. Asked about instances in which demonstrators across the country have used anti-Semitic language, Mr. Kassar replied, "Those people suck. They're not a part of the peace movement," he said. Anybody that's motivated by hatred, be it racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, hatred of any form, they're not peaceful. But to other Democrats, instances of intimidation and harassment described by some Jewish students are a defining feature of the campus movement. Nowhere have those tensions been more clear than at Columbia University, which has become both an epicenter of the protest movement and a focal point for its detractors. Democrats, including President Biden, House and Senate leaders, and prominent Senate candidates, such as Representatives Adam Schiff in California and Ruben Gallego in Arizona, have condemned anti-Semitic harassment around Columbia. Other Democrats have sought to show solidarity in person with Jewish students who have described feeling unsafe. Representative Jared Moskowitz, a Florida Democrat, recently visited the campus with several other Jewish lawmakers. Some in his party, he said, were downplaying the hardline nature of some of the demonstrations. There are people who are peaceful and there are not, he said. But there's a denial from my friends on the left, a view that everyone's peaceful, there's no anti-Semitism. He declined to name names, though he and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have sparred on social media. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez of New York, one of several progressive lawmakers who have visited the Columbia encampment, has also condemned horrific people wandering outside Columbia's campus who espouse virulent anti-Semitism. But broadly, Mr. Moskowitz argued, some on the left who rightfully criticized anti-Semitic chants from white Aryan-looking men with tiki torches rallying in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017 seemed reluctant to denounce threatening speech when it came from liberal-leaning Americans. "I don't see the same level of outrage," Mr. Moskowitz said. "It's politically inconvenient now." Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, a long-serving Jewish member of Congress, has also expressed concerns about anti-Semitism. But he said his party was consistent in calling out bigotry, in contrast to many Republicans pointing to Charlottesville. Mr. Moskowitz shared that assessment about Republicans. "Democrats are willing to call out anti-Semitism wherever it is, and certainly there's been some anti-Semitism on campuses," Mr. Nadler said, though he questioned how representative the demonstrations were of the student body. Lauren Hitt, a spokeswoman for Mr. Biden's campaign, said that while Donald Trump stood proudly with white supremacists and encouraged violent crackdowns on peaceful demonstrators, Mr. Biden defends the First Amendment and has strengthened protections against anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. In Georgia, where demonstrators at Emory University were subdued forcefully, State Representative Rua Roman said that there is no room for anti-Semitism in this movement. But she warned against focusing on a few agitators over the thousands of students who are welcoming, who believe in a multiracial, multicultural, multi-faith world. "When we lose young people, we're not just losing at the ballot box," said Ms. Roman, a Democrat who is Palestinian. "We're losing them in the entire electoral apparatus. In the meantime, some Republicans are seeking to paint the whole Democratic Party as extreme and overly attuned to concerns of Ivy League protesters. Democrats are demonstrating that they're listening to a very small, very radical, very online segment of their base that is not representative of the broader electorate," said Jack Pandle, a spokesman for the House Republican campaign arm, which is selling T-shirts that allude to a profanity aimed at Hamas. Former Representative Steve Israel, who led the House Democratic campaign arm, said that while Republicans might see a messaging opportunity, it was far too early to determine whether it would be potent come November. "Campuses generally clear out in summer. The energy on this issue may dissipate, and the question will be whether it returns in the fall," he said. "The answer to that isn't here. It's in the Middle East." Okay, so we have some extra time. Now we're moving on to the next article. At Trump's trial, a window into the golden era of tabloids. The testimony of David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, included stories of celebrity encounters and his own wild journalistic tactics. This article is written by Michael Rothfeld. Inside a staid Manhattan courtroom this week, flashes from a bygone era appeared. Recollections of a celebrity-studded world of leveraged secrets and traded favors, and one in which publications sold at supermarket checkout counters wielded real cultural and political power. It was a world that David Pecker, the first witness called in Donald J. Trump's criminal trial and the former publisher of the National Enquirer, once presided over. Mr. Trump, his old friend and associate, sat silently at the defense table as Mr. Pecker testified not only about their own dealings, but also about his brushes with other celebrities, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mark Wahlberg, Tiger Woods. His testimony over 4 days evoked the sensational transactional tactics of tabloid newspapers and magazines, but it was also particular to Mr. Pecker, who over 2 decades ran American Media Incorporated, the Enquirer's parent company, commingling journalism and business interests to an extent that other executives had not in his slowly dying industry, according to people familiar with his career. Once called the tabloid king, Mr. Pecker, 72, had been written about often in his decades-long career, but he had never spoken so publicly about how he operated before taking the witness stand. Under questioning from prosecutors for Alvin L. Bragg, the Manhattan District attorney, Mr. Pecker walked the jury through his role in an effort to suppress negative news about Mr. Trump during the 2016 presidential election. He said he helped orchestrate hush money deals related to supposed sexual encounters and an uncorroborated story about an out-of-wedlock child. That scheme, prosecutors said, provides context for the charges that Mr. Trump criminally falsified records at his company to cover up one of those deals, a $130,000 hush money agreement with a porn star, Stormy Daniels, on the eve of the election. Mr. Trump denies Ms. Daniels' claims that they had sex. One of Mr. Trump's lawyers, Emil Bove, tried to get Mr. Pecker to admit that what he did for Mr. Trump in 2016, paying the sources of negative stories and then never publishing them, and manipulating headlines to aid his friend's campaign, was standard operating procedure. Mr. Pecker obliged to a point, describing others he had helped in the past, people his employees had branded FOPs for friends of Pecker. There was Mr. Schwarzenegger, who ran for governor in California's recall election in 2003 and ultimately won. Mr. Pecker had just purchased a group of muscle and fitness magazines from Mr. Schwarzenegger's mentor, Joe Wilder, who introduced him to the star. When they met, Mr. Schwarzenegger noted that he had been on the covers of the muscle magazines dozens of times, and he had also been the focus of negative stories in the tabloids Mr. Pecker also owned. And he said, "I plan on running for governor, and I would like for you not to publish any negative stories on me now," Mr. Pecker recalled. He agreed to the request and made Mr. Schwarzenegger an editor at large. After Mr. Schwarzenegger announced his run for governor, women contacted the Inquirer to sell their stories on different relationships or contacts and sexual harassment that they felt Arnold Schwarzenegger did, Mr. Pecker said, and I ended up buying them for a period of time. It was his first so-called catch and kill for a politician. His staff called it the David Pecker Project. Mr. Pecker testified that he had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars killing such stories, mostly in small increments. Eventually, the Los Angeles Times reported on some of Mr. Pecker's dealings involving Mr. Schwarzenegger, who denied knowledge of them. State officials investigated his hiring of Mr. Schwarzenegger as an editor, who had to resign, Mr. Pecker said. He testified that the episode had alerted him to the possible dangers of violating election laws. A decade later, after Mr. Schwarzenegger left office, Mr. Pecker protected him again, paying for a photocopy of a nude picture of him as a young bodybuilder. A representative for Mr. Schwarzenegger could not be reached for comment. Mr. Pecker is no longer publisher of the Inquirer, but remains a consultant to American media. His once booming industry declined over the years as mainstream outlets expanded their gossip coverage and the internet eroded tabloid readership. Mr. Pecker explained the methods he described this week as beneficial to business, but he did not invent them. They dated virtually to the Inquirer's birth. Its founder, Generoso Jean Pope Jr., bought the weekly New York Inquirer in 1952 with an interest-free loan from his godfather, the mobster Frank Costello, and agreed not to write critical stories about organized crime, Mr. Pope's son Paul had said. He transferred it into a national tabloid and moved it to Florida in 1971, poaching British reporters trained in hard-charging coverage of crime and the glitterati. Mr. Pope and those who followed him at the paper sometimes killed negative stories in exchange for interviews or a different scoop, or holding on to them as chits to be repaid later. But those were usually stories that were not quite right for the publication anyway. The Inquirer aggressively covered Mr. Trump during his rise as a celebrity developer in New York, chronicling the Donalds' romantic flings, marriages, and divorces. Mr. Pecker said he met Mr. Trump in part through Ronald Perelman, a businessman and big advertiser whom the Inquirer had also protected. Mr. Pecker later created a magazine called Trump Style, glorifying the mogul's brand, and held a launch party at Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida for George, a political magazine he published that was founded by John F. Kennedy Jr. "He was very helpful in introducing me to other executives and other people in New York," Mr. Pecker testified of Mr. Trump. And he would always advise me of parties or events or things that I would either go to or send, at that time, my editors to. When Mr. Pecker investors bought the Inquirer, he said, Mr. Trump was among the first to call and congratulate him. From then on, Mr. Pecker said, Mr. Trump was protected by his tabloid company. Mr. Pecker also promoted his presidential flirtations before the elections of 2000 and 2012. Mr. Trump became even more important to Mr. Pecker with his rise as a reality star on The Apprentice. Mr. Trump sent him the ratings and other content for free, and he would publish it. It was a great mutual beneficial relationship, Mr. Pecker said. Questioning Mr. Pecker on Thursday, Mr. Bove, the lawyer for Mr. Trump, ticked through others who had received his protection. He asked about compromising photographs that Mr. Pecker had purchased of Tiger Woods, whose affairs were tabloid fodder, that were used to get Mr. Woods to sit down for an interview despite his exclusive relationship with another publication. The purpose of buying the photographs was to leverage them against Tiger Woods to get him in the magazine, right? Mr. Bove asked, and Mr. Pecker agreed. A representative for Mr. Woods could not be reached. Mr. Pecker also testified that he had suppressed stories to aid Ari Emanuel, a prominent talent agent who Mr. Pecker said he had known since the 1990s. The actor Mark Wahlberg, a client of Mr. Emanuel's, once had a dispute with his wife that was bubbling and going to come out. Mr. Pecker testified, adding that he told Mr. Wahlberg's representatives where to buy the story. The Inquirer never published it. And Mr. Pecker said he spent $20,000 to buy and quash the story of an affair involving Rahm Emanuel, Mr. Emanuel's brother, who was running for mayor of Chicago in 2011 after he had served as then-President Obama's chief of staff. Representatives for Ari Emanuel and Mr. Wahlberg cannot be reached for comment. A representative for Rahm Emanuel declined to comment. Early in the week, Mr. Pecker testified that as Mr. Trump sought the presidency in 2016, he had offered to be the candidate's eyes and ears, and later advised Mr. Trump to buy one story, a Playboy model's account of their affair, to take it off the market. Mr. Pecker ended up doing that himself for $150,000. That later led to his company admitting it had tried to influence the election in a non-prosecution agreement with federal prosecutors in 2018. After Mr. Trump sought to compare that deal to what Mr. Pecker had done so many... Oh, after Mr. Trump's lawyers sought to compare that deal to what Mr. Pecker had done so many times before, one of the prosecutors, Joshua Steinglass, tried to make a distinction. He asked Mr. Pecker how many of the hundreds of non-disclosure agreements that his company had reached over the years had been coordinated by him as the chief executive officer with a presidential candidate for the benefit of the campaign. It's the only one, Mr. Pecker said. Okay, so we have still a little time left, so the next article I'll read is, In a Communist Stronghold, Capitalists Become an Economic Lifeline. Cuba's communist revolution took aim at private businesses, making them largely illegal. Today they are proliferating while the socialist economy craters. By David C. Adams. David C. Adams visited more than a dozen private businesses in Havana to document the growth of the private sector. A modern grocery store whose shelves are packed with everything from pasta to wine fills a spot in the central Havana once occupied by drab state-owned flower shops, in its ceilings and walls repaired and repainted. A former state glass company in a Havana suburb now houses a showroom for a private business selling Cuban-made furniture. And at the Cuban capital's port, forklifts carefully unload American eggs from a refrigerated container. The eggs are bound for an online private supermarket that, much like Amazon Fresh, provides home delivery. These ventures are part of an explosion of thousands of private businesses that have opened in recent years across Cuba, a remarkable shift in a country where such enterprises have not been permitted and where Fidel Castro rose to power, leading a communist revolution determined to eliminate capitalist notions like private ownership. But today, Cuba is confronting its worst financial crisis in decades, driven by government inefficiency and mismanagement, and a decades-long U.S. economic embargo that has led to a collapse in domestic production, rising inflation, and constant power outages and shortages of fuel, meat, and other necessities. So the island's communist leaders are turning back the clock and embracing private entrepreneurs, a class of people they once vilified as filthy capitalists. Taking advantage of loosened government restrictions granting Cubans the legal right to set up their own enterprises, roughly 10,200 new private businesses have opened since 2021, creating a dynamic, if fledgling, alternative economy alongside the country's hobbled socialist model. Underscoring the growth of private businesses and the government's economic travails, private sector and government imports last year each totaled about $1 billion, according to government data. Much of the private sector imports came from the United States and were financed by cash remittances sent by Cubans there to relatives back home. About 1.5 million people work for private businesses, a 30% jump since 2021, and they now represent almost half of the total workforce on the Caribbean island. Never has the private sector been given so much space to operate in Cuba, said Pavel Vidal, who studies Cuba's economy and is a university professor in Cali, Colombia. The government is bankrupt, so it has no other choice but to invite other actors in. Despite the private sector's growth, its overall contribution to Cuba's economy, while increasing, remains modest, accounting for about 15% of gross domestic production. Still, the economic transformation is significant enough that it is leading to deep divisions in the island's communist system as new business elite acquires wealth, something anathema to Cuba's revolutionary ideology. Cubans working for the state, including white-collar professionals, doctors, and teachers, make the equivalent of roughly $15 a month in Cuban pesos, while employees in the private sector can make 5 to 10 times that amount. A government salary does not go very far in the private stores that have popped up, where a bag of Italian potato chips costs $3, a bottle of good Italian wine $20, and even an everyday need like toilet paper costs $6 for a pack of 10 rolls. Most customers who can afford those kinds of prices receive money from abroad, work for other private businesses, or are diplomats. You have to be a millionaire to live in Cuba today, said Yoandris Hirazuelo, 38, who sells fruit and vegetables from a cart in Havana's Vedado neighborhood, earning about $5 a day. The state can no longer meet the basic needs of the population. Cuban government officials said the legislation of private businesses was not a grudging acceptance of capitalism for the sake of economic survival, making it clear that state-run industries still dwarf the private sector's role in the economy. It's not an improvised strategy, Sutset Rosales, the planning and development director at the Ministry of Economy, said in an interview. We have a very clear idea of the pathway for gradual recuperation of the economy with the incorporation of new economic actors that are complementary to the socialist state economy. But U.S. officials say that the growth of private businesses could be a game changer, paving the way for greater democratic and economic freedom. The question is, are they enough? Said Benjamin Ziff, the charge d'affaires who heads the United States Embassy in Cuba. Cuba is falling apart faster than it is being rebuilt. There is no turning back. A key question, he added, is whether the government will allow the private sector to expand fast enough and freely enough to meet the challenges. Cuba's rapidly expanding private sector has attracted deep skepticism within Miami's staunchly anti-communist Cuban exile community, where many dismiss it as a ruse by Cuba's communist leaders to ride out the economic crisis and cling to power. Representative Maria Elvira Salazar, a Republican and one of South Florida's three Cuban Americans in Congress, led a congressional hearing in January about private business titled The Myth of the New Cuban Entrepreneurs and suggested that licenses for such ventures were reserved for relatives of Cuban government officials. The Cuban regime is still in the business of power, and there's nothing that proves to me that they're willing to give a portion of that market share to anybody else but themselves, she said in an interview. Since banning private businesses in the 1960s, Cuba has in fact experimented with free market practices during other times of hardship, only to roll them back later when economic pressures eased. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 1990s and left Cuba without its main economic benefactor, the government issued a limited number of self-employment licenses for some low-income tradespeople, including barbers and tire repairers. After President Barack Obama restored diplomatic relations with Cuba in 2015 and relaxed the U.S. embargo, American tourists flooded the island and U.S. companies began exploring investments. Still, the Communist Party never fully embraced the private sector, regarding it as a potential Trojan horse for Yankee imperialists. Then came a double blow. Donald J. Trump's election in 2016 led to the restoring of sanctions on Cuba, including a ban on U.S. cruise lines sailing there. 3 years later, the COVID-19 pandemic shut down Cuba's tourism sector entirely, its largest source of foreign currency. Since then, Cuba has been in financial free fall. Production of pork, rice, and beans, food staples, plunged by more than half between 2019 and 2023, according to the government. This year, Cuba requested for the first time help from the United Nations World Food Program, provide enough powdered milk for children, the state-run media reported. A lack of oil and an aging electrical grid have led to rolling blackouts across the country. The worsening living conditions triggered a rare public display of unhappiness in March as hundreds of people took to the streets of Santiago de Cuba, the country's second largest city, chanting power and food, according to social media and official government reports. The economic hardships have set off an enormous surge in emigration. Since 2022, roughly 500,000 Cubans have left the island, and extraordinary exodus for a country of 11 million, and most Cubans who have left have gone to the United States. Amid so much deprivation, privately run small businesses offer a small dose of hope for those with the money to open them and for their employees. Many are taking advantage of regulations introduced in 2021, granting Cubans the legal right to set up their own enterprises, which are limited to 100 employees. Across Havana, new delis and cafes are appearing, while entire office floors are leasing space to young entrepreneurs, bursting with business plans and products from construction and software to clothes and furniture. Okay, so that is all that we have time for. This is Cindy reading from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Thank you so much for listening.